It's my pleasure to welcome Cindy. So the AA committee let me know that they had invited Cindy to speak, and she and I had a chance to connect on the 4th of July. So in talking to Cindy, there were so many similarities in our stories. It only took me saying, "So, how did you find Al-Anon?" And we were off chatting. So I'm always reminded that this is a disease of isolation. And being not honest and open with another Al-Anon member breaks that isolation. So join me in welcoming Cindy from Freiburg.
Thank you very much, Christine, for that welcome and for everybody here. So I was going to start with a moment of silence and the Serenity Prayer, and we've already done that. So I thought maybe instead we would start with the Al-Anon Declaration, if you'd all like to join me in that. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, let the hand of Al-Anon and Al-Ateen be there, and let it begin with me. So I'd like to thank the committee. I'd like to thank Jean for asking me to come. I'd like to thank Jean to say this is not in my wheelhouse would be an understatement. But I am happy to be here, and I'm grateful. I want to thank Nikki for the warm welcome. Lots of fun little goodies in my room when I got here. And Christine for reaching out to me and making me feel welcome. I've never been to this conference before. It's a first for me. I was born and raised in Maine, ironically enough, but not a skier, so I've never been to what I was told is called the Loaf. But I work with a gentleman over in North Conway, and he's a PA, an orthopedic PA, and when he asked me what I was doing this weekend, I said, "I'm going up to Sugarloaf." He goes, "Oh my God, the Loaf! I learned to ski there." And he gave me all sorts of tips. I think he probably drank here, too. So anyway, it's so exciting to be live, right? I mean, this is amazing. I'm very active in the NEFOTS committee, and my first year on the committee, we made the decision, like, in March that we weren't going to go live. And it was devastating because it's an end of March. It's an end of March conference, and we were at our last committee meeting, getting ready to go, and we had to shut it down. And it was a tough decision. So we weren't able to do anything that year because it was too late when we closed it down. So we've been 2 years on Zoom, and we are so excited that we're going to be live this year. I want to plug it. It's NEFOTS in Portland, Maine, New England Fellowship of the Spirit, March 24th, 25th, 26th. You're all welcome. It's a big book conference, very similar to this one. It's wonderful. So I'll skip the panic attack spiel. I don't think I'm going to have one, but if I hit the floor, you know, start breathing heavy or sweating or clutch my chest, don't call 911, really. It's not necessary. Don't bother the EMS. It's just a little panic attack. My home group is the North Conway All Addictions meeting. We meet every Wednesday at 7 o'clock at the Gibson Center in North Conway. We just went live a month ago, and it's amazing. We do offer a hybrid meeting now because we met so many people over the last couple years from other states, and we wanted to keep them with us. So you're all welcome. We've been about 11 years now there. So my story, right? A time of change. How it was, what happened, and what it's like today is all about the change that came over me. To be up here speaking about my father or the family disease of alcoholism is really kind of weird because as I grew up in that family, you didn't talk about it. The elephant in the living room was invisible. You were told, don't air the dirty laundry, don't talk about the problems, leave it in the home. So to stand up here today and talk about what happened is, it's odd, but it's freeing, and we're all of the same, whether we drink or obsess or whatever our addiction is, what I've learned in this program, whatever our addiction is, whatever it is that we use to help with the pain of our addiction can be healed with this process. Doesn't matter what it is. I sponsor women in Al-Anon. I sponsor people in OA. My sponsor through the 12 steps in the big book was an alcoholic. It's all the same. What she told me when I asked her to sponsor me, and we talked a bit about her being an alcoholic and mine not really being an alcoholic, simply an Al-Anon, simply. She said that the book, this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is a solution. You know, abstinence, just putting down the drink, and now I'm drawing a blank, but bear with me for just a minute. The cure for alcoholism, putting down the drink, abstinence, okay, that's the easy part. You know, that's the solution, the spiritual recovery that we all need to recover from our disease, no matter what it is the 12 steps. Abstinence is just the beginning. Because, like I said, whatever we use to fill that hole is really the solution to my problem. It's what I use to take care of that pain. I drank alcoholically for a year or two. I'm not an alcoholic. When my husband at the time said, "You're a drunk and you need to stop," I dared him, you know, how long do you want me to stop for? And I did it, right? And then when I was done, I was off again saying, you know what, I'm just a partier, you know? So I'm not alcoholic. But I'm definitely Al-Anon, for sure. So I was profoundly affected by this disease of alcoholism in my family of origin. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom was, I don't like to call her codependent, or she was there, right? Doing the best that she could. And I have three sisters, so there were four girls. My childhood was childhood was emotionally and mentally just, the development was bad because of the disease of alcoholism. In my family, we were all victims of this disease. No one escaped. I'd love to see my three sisters in Al-Anon. They're not. But maybe someday, you know. So the effects of the disease, they're long-standing. And they're seemingly different for all of us. I can remember talking about events with my sisters that occurred as a child, and they're like, "That didn't happen." I went, "Well, it sure did." And they'll talk about things, and I'll say, "Well, I must not have been there." "Well, yeah, Cindy, you were right in the middle of it." Isn't that amazing how that happens, right, in life? So for me, it was extreme confusion. Nothing was as it seemed in that family. My dad's disease was progressive, you know, so when I was about 10 or 11 or 12, it's when it really started getting quite bad. Confusion, lies, pretending that everything's okay, lots of tears, fights, violence. But I always had a sense that I was just late to the game, I mean, late to the dance. I didn't understand anything. It's like, I needed someone to tell me the rules of life because I didn't get it. I felt very lost a lot of the time. And I was kind of resentful because I thought, why hasn't anybody let me in on this secret on how to live? Because I just couldn't figure it out. I was not a sad kid, but I was definitely not a kid. I was playing an adult role in that family all the time. I prided myself on being my mother's protector at 10. Another thing that happened to me in that family is I developed a total lack of ability to trust anyone. I can remember laying in my bed at night saying, oh, wow, my father, he's drinking all the time. My mom's an emotional mess. Who's going to take care of me? Oh, I'll take care of myself. This is like at age 10, 11, 12. These memories are there. I lived in a constant state of worry and fear. We call it fear. No, I'm only joking. Worry and fear. Can anyone relate? I worried when there was nothing to worry about. I obsessed over my obsessions. It was amazing. So in the family, I decided, maybe subconsciously, that I would become the protector. I was the watcher. I was the sentry. I was the town crier. You know, it's, 10 o'clock and all's well. You know, dad's asleep. It's going to be a good night. I once heard a man say that the alcoholic takes away another human being's ability to be at ease. And when I heard him say that, I thought, wow, there is so much truth to that statement. So much truth. So I was the one that when things got hairy and out of control and, I mentioned violence, there was some, I would jump out of bed, I would pick up the phone, I would call the friend of my dad, say, come help. I would call the family doctor, who was also a drinking buddy, but he would come help. I would call my dad's parents. My dad was an only child. Calling my grandparents was never a good idea. Because the next morning, my dad would be like, what the heck, Cindy? Why did you do that? Now, a little kid, this is what I'd say to him. Well, Dad, it's kind of like this. I know that if you hurt Mom, you would regret it for the rest of your life. So I'm just trying to help you not hurt Mom. And that's why I asked for help. And I'm like, can you imagine a kid like trying to rationalize that to an adult? I mean, it was insane. I didn't know it at the time. It was just the way I lived. And there was fallout for these cries for help because, I had an older sister, a year and a half older, and she was a lot more, she and my dad were good buddies. And so when I would do these things, not only would I get in trouble with my dad, I'd get in trouble with her. But I did, act when things happened. I guess it may have been in my nature in utero. It may have been something that I developed just watching all of the stuff happen, but I would act. And I'm not the oldest, so. And I couldn't tell you, like I said, in these moments of crisis, I couldn't tell you what my other sisters were doing. I had no clue. I just remember me doing what I did. And I felt like I was totally alone fighting this thing. You talk about the alcoholic who treats his loneliness with isolation. It is so true for us as well, right? So I don't ever remember feeling hatred for my dad, which is a good thing. I just felt horrible sadness and hopelessness constantly. And I used to think he chooses alcohol over me, right? Rum and Coke, Cindy, right? The rum and Coke always seemed to win, right? And what I know now is that isn't even true. That's what this program has given me, is the knowledge that that isn't even close to the truth. He'd lost the power of choice. He had a disease. I know now, I can recognize it. And he loved me more than anything, as he loved my sisters and as he loved my mom. He just had an illness. He had a physical allergy and a mental obsession that cold stone sober would always lead him back to a drink, no matter what. I don't know. I know Alan, AA was around in the 50s. I was born in 57. I'm 60s is when a lot of this was bad, early 70s. I know AA was there. I lived in Poland Spring, Maine. I was born and raised there. I never knew of my dad going to a meeting. I never knew of anyone suggesting it. So I knew he had an illness. But everybody around us, friends, neighbors, family, put it on a moral, ethical basis, and so that's what I thought it was. It's so nice to know that that wasn't true. I mean, I wish I knew it then, but it's great that I know it now. So at about 14 or 15, my mom ended the marriage. She really had no choice. Her physical and emotional state was very bad. There were days when she'd take me to my piano lesson and she didn't know how to get me home. And I'd have to sit in the car and tell her what turn to take. And so she had basically, I guess what you'd call a nervous breakdown. And her physical condition deteriorated. And I mean, they say in the programs that the Al-Anons use the health insurance quicker and more often than the alcoholics. I'm not sure if that's true, but that's what I've heard. So she was badly bruised, and I continued to watch over her. She was I believed that I encouraged her to divorce him, that I urged her to. I begged her to get him out of the house so we could have safety and sanity. When she mentioned, should I divorce? I was like, yes, go for it, Mom. You're entitled to happiness. Really, I believed that I was driving the train, which would also come back to bite me and my disease, because I wasn't driving the train, you know? I wasn't. So she met an awesome guy who is my stepdad today, and they had 45, 50 years before she died. And life became amazing, peaceful. She became relaxed and happy. But the misconception that once the alcoholic is gone or the alcoholic stops drinking, life gets better, isn't always true. It wasn't true for me. Mom was okay, so I moved on, right? I went to school at Maine Medical Center. I became a certified surgical tech, scrub nurse, did that for, I'm still doing it. But I made choices in my life that I wouldn't have made had I not been totally focused on what other people thought I should be doing. Because that was a big thing for me. I'd say, well, I've made a decision. I'm going to go to school at Maine Medical Center. This is kind of how it would go. And my mom and my stepdad would say, oh, gee, you know, if they said, really, you think you want to do that? I'd be like, no, probably not. But if they said, wow, that's a great idea, I'd say, yeah, you think? And I would move on. And that's kind of what I did. I met the man that was to become my husband. We had a couple sons. And I soldiered on. But believe me, I brought my disease with me into my relationship and that marriage, and with my children. And then there were times when the alcoholic would become paramount in my life. He'd, you know, I felt guilty. I felt guilty that I hated to visit my dad in that empty apartment with bare furniture. I felt so guilty. I felt I'd put him there. I had so much power, didn't I, huh? So I actually participated in a treatment center that he was in. Any of you ever remember the circle and the two chairs in the middle? Has anyone ever done that? I don't recommend it, right? It was awful facing my father in a circle of strangers. I mean, his illness led to his death at 55. And it was an alcoholic death, and it wasn't pretty. There's a line in the book that we joke about, my husband now and I, about, you know, the alcoholic really has to think. Alcoholic death, spiritual recovery. Really, we have to think about it. But being the person in the medical field, I charged to the hospital to help my dad, to be with my dad. My sisters let me do it. Just call us, you know, let us know how he's doing. And it was a couple years of horrible stuff, you know. GI bleeds, porta cable shunts, yeah. Horrible. Intensive care visits. It was horrible, and the disease killed him, and I was there holding the basin of blood. And I had no idea that I was being traumatized by that. So I would just keep putting on my cape and running. So anyway, like I said, he died at 55, and I journey on unaware of how that disease comes with me. I brought all my defects of character into my marriage. You're probably somewhat familiar with some of them, right? Mothering, managing, manipulation, martyrdom. You know, I was great. I was great at that, right? You'd say, well, I'll do it myself. God, no, I'll do it for you. Or no, first, I'll show you how to do it. And then I'll kind of help you. And God, give it to me. I'll do it for you, right? Is there anyone here who can relate to that? My poor kids, right? Especially my firstborn, you know? And at about 18, I said, you know what, Christopher, you need to do this yourself. Oh, God, no, Mom, you do it, right? Yep. So worry, control, procrastination was big. People-pleasing, big one. You know, dishonesty, overdoing, like I said. And I didn't realize that as I was doing all of this stuff for the people around me that I loved more than life, right? My kids, my mom, my family, I was building resentments against them for letting me do it. Like, really? I didn't know how to live. I had no idea. So, big surprise, my marriage failed after about 20 years, but only because I wanted out. I was so unhappy. He wasn't a bad man. He didn't drink. He was probably a good alcoholic that never drank, but that's another story. But there had been so much. I mean, there was so much financial strife. There was a restaurant. There was a fire. He was charged with arson. There was IRS at the door. I mean, I could write a book, okay? And after all of that, and every time there was a crisis, I went running to fix it. You know, we have to go to court to talk about things. I would say, oh, I'll go. You know, I let him off the hook every damn day and blamed him for it. So I decided that I'm done. I just can't do this anymore. I'm getting sick. I'm fighting depression. I'm on medication. And I start partying at work. I worked in hospitality over in North Conway. Plenty of opportunity to party there, right? And I forgot to mention, I'd spent the last 34 years or so in North Conway. My husband and I just moved to Fryeburg, Maine. I am from Fryeburg now, but originally North Conway. So I was in hospitality, and I was doing a lot of partying. And I decided that I needed to be free. Took every ounce of energy and courage I had to do that, because I'm the Al-Anon that won't do anything for herself. I have to have a reason. And I'm like, God, why won't he just drink or cheat on me or just run his car into a tree? Anything. I want out of this marriage, right? Oh, you laugh. How many of you have thought that? I mean, come on. I was black and white. Everything was black and white. I was rigid, right and wrong. I'll never divorce. I won't put my children through that. I'll never drink like my father. I won't put my children through that. I broke every promise that I made. So I guess I knew it was time to make a change. I was depleted, run down, and sick, and getting sicker. I had this constant fantasy of a little cabin by a babbling brook in the woods, a rocking chair on the porch, and a dog by my side. And I dreamt that on a daily basis. And I finally decided to just do it. I wasn't going to tell this story, but after Dave last night, oh my gosh, Dave, right? When he talked about his brain healing and what a miracle it was. So I told you I had this fantasy. And I remember one day, about 2 weeks after my husband moved out, and I knew I was going to be okay, that I could do this with my teenage boys and me. I'd gotten a dog. So I was ironing in my bedroom, and this may or may not happen, but I felt so free. I felt so light. I felt like, oh my God, my life. I'm gonna start my life. This is amazing. That I actually felt like I levitated. Now, I don't know if I did or not. It startled me, and I like sat down on the floor because I was so taken back by the feeling. But maybe that was God saying, I'll lift you up, Cindy, and everything's going to be okay. So what did I do? I didn't get that cottage by the river or the rocking chair or the babbling brook or the, yeah, I did get the dog, but I got into a relationship. And it gets better. I got into a relationship with an alcoholic. So my now husband, when I met him, was 14 years sober. And I was quite sure that he was God, right? 14 years, my dad couldn't put together 14 days. This is great. And we were going to AA meetings, and it was fun, right? I felt happy, joyous, and free for the first time in a long time. And my uneducated mind told me that Laird was solid. So we were going to AA meetings together. It's fun, exciting. I loved hearing the stories. They were speaker meetings. Not a lot of talking about the steps, but they were meetings. Oh, they might have been talking about the steps. I wasn't hearing anything. To me, it was a social event. I'm sorry. So one night at this meeting, oh, they hated it when I made the platters, right, with the pepperoni and the cheese and the crackers, because everything was just so. The alcoholics hated to touch it, right? Don't ask her to bring the snacks, right? So one night at this meeting, there was a man sitting there. He looked like my dad. He talked like my dad. He's telling his story. And I'm like, huh. I was getting more angry by the minute listening to this man. And we get in the car to leave, and I'm fuming, and it's not my nature. I was pretty happy and optimistic at that time. And Laird says, what's going on? That guy. And Laird said, wow, have you ever heard of Al-Anon? And I'm like, what's Al-Anon? That was my introduction. That was my introduction not that many years ago, right? 18, 19 years ago. So I started going to a family group of Al-Anon in North Conway Friday nights. And I liked it a lot. There was a woman, people talked about double winners in this meeting. They were speaking a language. It's a foreign language when you first start going to these meetings. Does anyone know that? I mean, we don't know what in hell you're talking about. Double winner? What the heck's a double winner? So. And, you know, newcomers are kind of afraid to ask questions. We want to know. We nod our head. We cry. So I learned a little bit in the first few weeks, and this woman was speaking one night, and she was so serene. I mean, the sereneness was pouring off her. And I loved her. And she talked about her recovery, my recovery, my recovery. So I thought, oh, she's a double winner. Well, that's great. And so I went up to her afterwards, and I said, her name was Diane. I said, Diane, so are you an alcoholic in addition to Al-Anon? I said, are you a double winner? And she said, no. And I said, you're not an alcoholic? She goes, no. I said, you talked about recovery. What are you talking about? She goes, well, Cindy, there's recovery for us Al-Anons, too. And I'm like, so sick. What do we have to recover from? Is basically what I said to her. It shows you where I was, right? So, about this time, only a year, in my new relationship, I noticed things are a little weird. Things aren't measuring up right. Laird's behavior is a little strange. I'm finding things in his apartment that he says belongs to the landlady, like a bottle of something. Oh, she comes over here to drink to get away from Ronnie. Oh, okay, cool. She comes over here to smoke to get away from Ronnie. Oh, awesome. And I started developing suspicions. Long story short, Laird had a slip, which we know is possible. Because we know this is a terminal relapsing disease without a spiritual experience, without recovery, right? That's what we know. I didn't know that then. And so 1 year in, after 14 years of sobriety, he meets me. What does he do? He picks up. Guess whose fault it is? So I experienced an Al-Anon-ism that I had never experienced in my life, ever. Being an adult child of an alcoholic was bad enough, but this was out of control. I became a crazy woman. I was a lunatic. I felt, and if anyone can relate to this, I really felt like I was fighting for my life. And I have no idea why that was. There was a feeling of desperation that I had never felt before. Obviously, I was very much in love and I wanted this to work, but this was something bigger than that. I have no idea what it was. I was ransacking his apartment, I was ripping through his clothes, I was looking for evidence everywhere. And he was being pretty understanding about it, considering. It was total insanity, and I started to really spiral into panic attacks. I'd never had them before, anxiety disorder, significant depression that wound me back into a therapist's office. And what do? I 100% totally focus on him. 100%. I'm sorry, Nikki. I wasn't supposed to pound the podium. I told her I'm not a pounder. 100% on him. That was my, I mean, it was so crazy. I don't have to tell you anymore how crazy it was. So it all comes to a head. He admits and confesses, only because I'm standing at his car with some bottles. So, but he goes back to his sponsor, who probably didn't know he was his sponsor, right? And that sponsor trades him to another sponsor in this meeting that we used to go to. And so he's going to meetings again and getting better, and I'm getting sicker. And I don't know why that happened, but it did. And then when that wasn't working for him, that meeting, this new sponsor said, Laird, I don't know what they're doing with the big book up in Conway, but you need to go there. And so he started going to a big book meeting, a structured big book meeting, and was really getting better. And we started driving all over New Hampshire and Maine. There was Saco, there was Newington, there was Portland, there was Dover, North Conway, and I went to every single meeting with him, and he was getting better and I was getting sicker. If he was out of my line of vision at a meeting, I'd have a panic attack. We rode an hour and a half to every meeting. We usually were in good spirits and we'd talk and we'd get there, and on the way, an hour and a half home was quiet. I'd go to work sometimes, and if he didn't answer his phone on the third ring, I would jump in my car. I would leave my desk in the operating room, jump in my car, drive to where he worked, and I wouldn't even remember getting there. I was sick, curled up in a ball in my bed. I won't say I was suicidal. I don't think I ever thought that that would be the answer. But I didn't really want to live anymore like that. Physically, I developed all the conditions my mom had. Gastritis so bad I couldn't even drink water, and lost all sorts of weight. Anyway, so the new sponsor said to Laird, go to Thursday night. And this new sponsor he was then traded to said, you're going to go to NEFOTS. And Laird said, what's NEFOTS? And our first year there, right in the front seat, like my friends here. And we cried the whole time. Someone said, I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I hit him, like, he said recovered. What does that mean? Right? And then I heard an Al-Anon get up, because at NEFOTS, there's a panel on all the steps, two alcoholics and an Al-Anon, and they share their story. And I heard an Al-Anon person get up, and he waved around the big book, and not the big book, the Blueprint for Progress. And he talked despairingly about it. And I thought, what? And then I heard another Al-Anon person say that the speaker, Juanita from New Mexico, talked And I was captivated by her and her story, and she worked out of the Big Book. I thought, well, that's amazing. The Big Book is, okay, right? I'm trying to figure this all out. But I saw a light coming on in eyes everywhere that I wanted more than anything. I wanted to get better. I wanted this relationship to work, and I wanted to be happy. So I came back. I came back to my Al-Anon meeting on that Friday night, and I started talking about this conference, and I was on fire, and I was so excited, and I mentioned the Big Book, and I got shushed. And let me tell you, that was the first resentment I had to write out when I got into this process. And it was explained to me quietly and politely and correctly that Al-Anons don't do the work out of the Big Book. Or they can, but it's not conference-approved literature, so you don't talk about it at this meeting. And it was totally understood and respected by me. But it's how I wanted to do it. And I found a sponsor who took me through the steps. So she had me read the first 63 pages. We read them together, line by line. I underlined. I talked about words I didn't understand. She said, you're going to admit you're powerless. I'm like, no. Al-Anons are not powerless. We have all the power. What are you talking about? I mean, if it wasn't for us, right? So we worked on that a little bit. She changed my thinking. I knew my life was unmanageable. That part I got right quick. Came to believe. That was a hard one for me. There was a childhood Jehovah's Witness religion in my family, which is probably why my father drank, but that's another story. His parents were very, very rigid, and he just could not go there. And anyway, it was hard for me to understand a God with that little piece of stuff still in my brain. Came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. I'm like, wow, that's big, right? And I worked with that step with my sponsor for a while because I just didn't want it to be God. And I read something the other day. It says, you're not stuck. What I am is committed to a certain pattern of behavior that's become more hurtful than helpful. And that's when I realized that all those strengths that I thought I had developed in my childhood were my powers. And now they were coming around like a boomerang and cutting me to ribbons, right? So those certain patterns of behavior become more hurtful than helpful. Keep applying the same old formula to a new level in life. Nothing changes if nothing changes, right? Get a new formula, right? And so that's what I decided to do. My sponsor said, we're not going to spend too much time on step two. I'm not going to try to convince you that you aren't the one who's going to fix this, Cindy. We're going to move on to step three. And this was her battle cry with me. The best way to do step two is to do step three. And the best way to do step three is to do step four. And every time I got stuck, she'd say, let's go. I love this woman. The book is full of instructions, promises, and warnings. And that's what I love about this book. The prayers, the promises, the instructions. It made it very simple for this Al-Anon who was black and white, yes or no. I was able to follow the instructions. Three, made a decision. Now this one was tough because I'm an Al-Anon and I don't make decisions. I'd rather you make them so I can blame you when they're all messed up, right? But we worked real hard at this. And again, I kind of waffled a little on this. And she said, okay, let's get a notebook, Cindy, and you're going to start writing. And on I went to step four. We took a formal step three. I will say this. I took this formal step three with my sponsor. It was just amazing. In the bottom of the church. I call it the Brown Church in Conway, New Hampshire. And we said the third step prayer together, we held hands. And I made this decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood God. And the way my life was going at that time, who wouldn't want to turn it over, right? I was a mess, physically, mentally, spiritually. So I started step four. I did the writing. Resentments, I said to her, you know, Annie, I'm not sure I have a lot of resentment. And she said, really? So what I discovered mostly is that what I called hurts were my resentments, you know? I like to say I didn't get angry at people because I didn't really know how to feel that. I got hurt. And when you hurt me, that was a resentment. And so that was easy for me to understand. I know now that it was silent scorn, which is kind of anger, right? But I definitely, I found plenty of names to put on that list and plenty of things to write about. And so the way my sponsor broke it down is, you know, we're going to do this inventory, Cindy, and you're going to write out all your resentments, and you're going to turn those around, and you're going to look at your part of that. Where were you selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid? And you're going to do that. And then you're going to turn it around. And all of those resentments and all of that bitterness and anger, we'll turn that around to patience, love, and tolerance for everybody in your life. And then we're going to do the fears. Now that I could get my head around. I had a list. I mean, hundreds. Most of them centered around the feeling of not being good enough, not being accepted, being found out, all of those fears. But there were some weird ones on there. I laugh now when I read them. There was hummingbirds was there. Oh, yeah. I'd like to see some of your lists. So I wrote out all these fears, and I answered four questions around the fears. Let's see if I can remember. Name the fear. Why do I have the fear? How does reliance fail me? How does self-reliance fail me? Every time, trying to fix all my problems with this head that doesn't work, right? And what's a better way? Trust and rely on God. I wrote it until I believed it. And she said, and when you're all done with that, all those fears, you're going to flip the opposite of that into faith and courage. And that sounded really good to me. And then I did my sex inventory. And I thought, well, this will be easy. None of this is hard, right? None of this is hard, but it's work. And it's deep. Soul-searching work. I didn't know I had a soul. I didn't know that I had Cindy somewhere in there. I was what anyone else wanted me to be. But this process of writing out this inventory showed me who I was and who I didn't want to be and what I could be with God's help, right? So I did the sex inventory. There's 9 questions. I did a good job with that. And then step 5, I was ready. This took me too long, by the way. I've decided after this weekend and listening to Dave last night, I made a decision that I'm going to get people through this quicker. It doesn't have to take as long as it took me. I didn't have to feel that pain as long as I did. But anyway, step 5. So I was all excited. I'm ready to go. I'm feeling better physically, mentally. And I say to my sponsor, I'm ready. My husband and I, we'd married in the midst of this. I'm not sure if we were, no, we hadn't married yet. Step 5, I was still dating. But anyway, we had a trip planned to Switzerland in about 3 weeks. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is going to be so amazing. I'm going to be traipsing around the Alps like Heidi and the goats. And I'm going to be singing. And the 5th step is going to be done. And I'm going to be happy, joyous, and free. And Annie says, I can't do the 5th step right now, Cindy. What? What? My plans and designs, right? I was pretty taken aback, and I'm like, huh. Her mother had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and she needed to do that. And I was still thinking about Cindy. I got over it real quick, went off to Switzerland, still felt good. Came back, did my fifth step with this angel, this woman who's just taken so many women through this process. She's just amazing. I did step 5, and 6 and 7 I complicated a little bit. Like Dave said last night, oh, it's just a couple paragraphs. Us Al-Anons, you know, we don't have character defects, really. It's you guys, you alcoholics, are the problem. So I complicated a little bit, and I said to my sponsor, well, okay, fine. I finally made my list of character defects in 6 and 7. She goes, really? I said, yeah. I says, I've got at least 30. She goes, that's odd, because there's only 4. And I said, excuse me? What do you mean there's only 4? There is selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. Cindy, those are your 4 character defects, your self-centeredness. And every character defect that I had written on that long list went under one of those categories. Make it simple, right? Keep it simple. So, 8 and 9, I thought, wow, I'm going to make a list, and I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to make amends. I had to really spend a lot of time with God. Through this process, I had been developing a relationship with God. God, my understanding that I choose to call God. My sponsor helped me define, she just helped me so much with that. And I have a vision that's nothing that I ever would have imagined before of my God. And she's known in our whole town and area as the person who says, just let God teach you about God. It'll happen. You do these 12 steps and you'll meet your God. And he'll meet you right where you are. And the book says God doesn't make too hard terms for those of us who seek him, right? So some amends, I started right off with my baby sister. It was amazing. You know, I felt she'd wronged me terribly about telling my mom something I didn't want my mom to know, which was that my son came home with a pregnant girlfriend from college. It was like, oh my God, the worst thing in the whole world. And I wanted to tell my mom myself. This would have been the first great-grandchild. Not really time for that child yet. But I wasn't telling my mom fast enough for my baby sister, so she told her. She thought she'd break the ice. I was furious. I felt betrayed. And I kept wanting to make this amend to her because I had sort of, we were so close, and I'd sort of pushed her away. And she felt it. So I go to make the amend to her, but before I do, I realize exactly why she did what she did. This is what God does. He shows us our selfishness. He shows us our dishonesty. And when I wrote it out, I realized she was trying to protect me and my son from any hurtful words my mom might say, right? Because my baby sister had become pregnant as a teenager. And apparently my mom didn't deal with it very well. And my sister carried those words in her heart. And she wanted to prepare my mom for this big news so that, and prepare me so that that wouldn't happen again. What she did out of love, and I saw it as a betrayal. It's amazing how wrong we can be sometimes, and how God shows us the truth. So I made an amend to my dad, who was dead. And this was a big one, because through this whole 12 steps, did you do this? Okay, through this whole thing, I learned about his disease. And what happened with this work was instead of remembering all of the horrible things, the time he sunk the boat on July 4th in a lake at midnight, you know, mom swimming around collecting life jackets, you know. He was always doing these kinds of things because he was the kind of guy that wanted to go out and have fun. And I used to think, oh, the ocean's fun. We'd have a ball at the ocean and my mom would come home. Oh my God, 4 kids and a dad who sits on the beach all day and drinks. And I used to think he was a fun guy. And I can imagine what her life was like. But anyway, so I used to think about all these scary things. That night on the 4th of July in the speedboat in the lake at dark was scary. We were rescued, nobody drowned, but it was frightening. And what was even worse was the next day in the camp on the little island, I could feel the stress between my parents at what had happened, what could have been a horrible tragedy. So I used to think of all these scary times. There were lots of them. You know, I never wanted to go on the ice in the wintertime, and he'd say, oh, stop it, Cindy, you know. I wouldn't do anything to hurt you. And the ice would crack around us. No wonder I was fearful. I remember a time at a skeet shoot. My dad was a great shooter, and we're at a skeet shoot, my sister and I and my dad, all day. And this, believe it or not, there's drinking involved in those things. I'm here to tell you, they're shooting clay pigeons, but they're also drinking. And about 4 o'clock at night, my dad looked at my sister and I and said, which one of you two is going to drive us home? I went, I'm 13. She's 14. I went, Dad? So he's with a bunch of friends, and they just let us go with him. And I remember that night sitting, I got right close to him. Bucket seats weren't around in those days, I don't think. Well, maybe they were, but I was able to sit right beside him the entire ride home, an hour. And every time he'd start to nod off, I'd poke him and wake him up. So those are the things I used to remember when I thought about my father. I just got a terrible anxiety in my stomach when I thought about that. But after I did this work, everything shifted. I started thinking about all the awesome things he did and was, and how much he loved us, and all the fun things we had. I stopped thinking about the near misses and the times when almost, and those violent moments. I stopped thinking about those, and I started thinking about him and his disease. He didn't choose this. He never would have chosen this. If he could have stopped, he would have. That would have been his choice. And I knew that from the bottom of my heart. And God gave me that gift. So I was able to go and make an amend to him at the graveside. And I wasn't talking about any of that. I was asking him to forgive me for not knowing his disease. My husband knows I feel the same way about him. So 10, 11, and 12, they're the ones that keep me going every day. I work them. If I do something at work, annoying or pesky or step on someone's toes, I'm in the health field and I have a control issue. I don't know. I immediately step up and say, I am so sorry. That's not the person I want to be. You didn't deserve that. I have a girl in my office who is so Al-Anon, right, for me to say. I don't know. She's living with an active alcoholic. I want her in this program so bad I can taste it. And I have to sit there every day and listen to the stories and the nightmares and the children. And I have to keep quiet, you know, and I do. But I reach out in private and say, hey, when you're ready. She texted me this morning, I couldn't believe it, and said, good luck, Cindy, you'll do great. And I cried, so I thought, God, I'd love to have her here. So life is good now with 10, 11, and 12. I sponsor women. I try to do an 11th step. If something's really bad, I write it out. I read it to somebody. Life is one of peace and love with God. I know myself. I know now where my worth comes from. I'm not in charge. I have to tell myself that a lot. I never was. Never was in charge. I know the difference between helping people and people pleasing. What's my motive is what I ask myself on a regular basis. Same way with my amends. My sponsor taught me, Cindy, where did you do harm? And where do you just feel bad? Because if you just feel bad and you didn't harm, that's not an amend, right? But it doesn't mean that life is always good. I think my time is almost up. Is it totally up? Life isn't always good, but I'll tell you one thing, and I'm not going to be able to talk much about it because I'm already crying. My mom got sick about 8 years ago with Alzheimer's, maybe 10 years ago. And I was really, really, really pissed at God. I'll tell you that right now. And I felt a separation. Being her protector and her savior and the one that basically was her God, right? Sick mind. So I got through it with help, with this program. I talked about it at meetings. One thing I couldn't do when Laird went out, I didn't ask for help. I wouldn't tell anyone. I didn't talk to my family, my friends, my coworkers, anyone in program. I kept it inside. Again, the secret, right? So with my mom, I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk about it. Talked about it at meetings a lot. They probably got tired of hearing about it. My dad kept her at home. I was actively involved in her care through the middle to latter stages. Every Tuesday, every weekend, cooking, helping. I will tell you, it was hell. But it was the best thing I ever did. And the fact that I was able to do it is God's miracle. Because I love that woman more than life. And she's at rest now, back in with God and her memories maybe. But for those of you who haven't done this work and maybe on the fence, it's the best thing you can do for yourself. It's the best thing I did for myself. Thank you very much.